So today we're this session is on APRA's other accumulations VERTA requirement, better known as the OAVR. And I will introduce the guys quickly. They'll probably present for maybe a wee bit less than 35 minutes, I think, Don, you were saying. So plenty of time for questions. Please use the app, but I think the guys have also said if you've struggled with typing because of fat fingers or whatever, there is a microphone that is obviously welcoming questions. If anybody wants to ask questions verbally, you are more than welcome. I'll introduce the guys quickly and then let them hand over to them to take us through their sessions. So Adrian McGarver is the Managing Director at PFS Consulting. Adrian qualified as an actuary in both Australia and the UK and has extensive experience with general insurance, reinsurance, corporate finance entities in Australia, UK and Switzerland. Adrian has over 25 years experience, including 7 years as a chief actuary at Global Insurance and Reinsurance Group, where he was responsible for pricing, reserving and capital, as well as providing significant input into underwriting and business strategy. Been at PFS for 8 years. 13 years. Okay. 13 years and the last 5 years as their managing director. Donald Johnson, better known as Don, but Donald on the list of delegates, is an actuary and risk management professional with 30 years of experience in the financial services in Australia, the USA, and the UK, none in Switzerland, by the way. He has worked at general insurer, life insurer, reinsurance broker, and several actuarial consulting firms. He has track record of identifying, quantifying risk and improving risk and capital management, insurance, reinsurance, banking, government and broking sectors. On the very last one, which I work in, I would love to find more out about more how he's managed risk in that world, given it's very prevalent. But I will hand over to Adrian, I think, who's going to kick things off.
Thanks, Carl. And Carl's also an experienced general insurance actuary, I understand, currently at Howden Re and formerly chief actuary of QBE. So as Carl's mentioned, we have a relatively short presentation. Just very quickly, the Actuaries Institute and we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands and waters where we live and work, travel and trade. We pay our respects to the members of those communities, elders past and present, and recognise and celebrate their continuing custodianship and culture. So, a bit of background. This is definitely a thorny topic. There's not many topics that make experienced actuaries shift in their seats or start sweating more than dealing with other accumulations. It's a very broad topic, and I think accordingly there very are likely a mix of people in the room in terms of their knowledge on this topic. There's certainly a few life actuaries here. There probably are some experts in particular lines of business, and we really would encourage their input on, you know, in those spaces where it exists. There's a few of us that have, and a few of you that we've worked together with before. Sort of a few points of background. Don, myself, Stephen, sort of up the front here, worked last year on producing a new technical paper for the Institute in general insurance relating to the use of catastrophe model output by actuaries. Now, that paper is not restricted to natural perils. It's intended to deal with all catastrophe models, and there are some, but that made us think of instances where those exist, particularly where they're non-natural peril related, and whether elements of the technical paper covered those sufficiently. So, you know, we went looking at that. There's also a technical paper published by the Institute in 2022, specifically on this topic of other accumulations, and we referenced that. And really the purpose of the presentation today is to thread a lot of those ideas together as much as possible, including sort of based on international experience, which is not always relevant in Australia. So some of the issues in the UK, like nuclear pools, for example, or, you know, space in orbit exposures, for example, are not big issues in Australia. But there are still things that can be learned from those. I think, background to the OAVR, which is necessary. Some people will know this by heart, I would say, but others won't. So we have one APRA person in the room, so they will know it by heart. So the general prudential standard 116 defines the requirement for calculating capital requirements under the standard method as, for the OAVR specifically, as the gross 1 in 200 year PML over a 12-month period, which is important, less the associated reinsurance recoveries in section 49, with adjustments for release of provisions and some premium adjustments across all classes of business and the whole of portfolio, which has been further clarified recently, I believe. So there's also a practice guide which provides guidance on, you know, as practice guides do, on the need for losses to be arising from a common dependent source is the language used, which is also important, and to consider multiple scenarios based on historical experience as well as hypothetical scenarios. So we cover a few of those issues through this presentation. Bit of background to the 2022 technical paper, which is riveting reading. It's 39 pages. But it covers a number of methodologies on scenario-based calculation methodologies. It provides quite a lot of detail on the mapping of PESTEL plus, so range of political, economic, social constructs by line of business and how they might be used to develop a series of events that could be considered as other accumulations. And it contains some work examples in detail in the sort of annexes to that document, which are sort of helpful references for this work. So I think on that note, I'll sort of hand to Don and come back. Don will present some of the public APRA data on other accumulations.
So what is the OAVR? How important is it? There's an amount of capital that APRA says you need to hold as a general insurer. As at March 2025, the latest available quarterly stats from APRA, that was about 20 bill across the industry, okay? Of that, the insurance concentration risk capital charge is about 20%. And the insurance concentration risk capital charge is a formula that is the maximum of four different concentration risk charges, which are natural perils vertical requirement, natural perils horizontal requirement, other accumulations vertical requirement, and the LMI concentration risk charge. So OAVR, the subject of this one, is the smallest of those four. So you think, well, it's okay, it's a small part of the total capital, but it is still reasonably sizable in that it's 300 mil. That's 1.4%-ish of the total. And for those where OAVR bites, it can be a lot higher percentage than 1.4%, as we will show shortly. Just to note, this is a snapshot, this slide, as at March 25. It moves up and down, and that's partly the nature of that formula. When it's the maximum of four different numbers, that which one drives the ICRC can change from one quarter to the next quite readily. And so the OAVR has varied from 227 mil to 338 mil over the last four quarters. Quite a reasonable amount of variation. So we're not going to, you know, get too pegged down on a particular point in time, but this is just a representative indication of how it fits in. Another important thing to note is that even when it's the OAVR that does not bite, okay, because one of those other characters, often the natural perils vertical requirement, might bite, you may find that the OAVR is not far behind. So multi-line insurers need to calculate often three different numbers. The NPVR, NPHR, and OAVR, apologies for all the acronyms, and then see which of the is the highest of those three, and you'll find that OAVR is often not too far behind. Typically, the natural perils requirements are the ones that dominate for property dominant insurers, and OAVR tends to be something that dominates for casualty dominant insurers. And then you obviously have a lot of insurers that are multi-line, and then it's a little bit harder to determine which one will dominate. But it's not just a neat split between those, because OAVR is relevant for property insurers. For example, in terrorism, where it's not a natural peril that leads to property damage. So if that's how important it is for the industry as a whole, then who is it particularly important for? The stats for this are older. The latest available from APRA, these are from the annual statistics that they produce, not the quarterly statistics. The latest available is June 2023, okay? So there's nearly a two-year disconnect between these two tables, so you won't be able to marry them up particularly well. But you can see that the overall total OAVR, 285 mil here compared to 301 mil on the previous slide. So at that level, they're somewhat similar. But when you look into the annual general statistics, they show some of the capital metrics for a number of individual insurers. And you can see in those individual insurers that, for example, at December 22, Atradius, a trade credit insurer, had a PCA, that's the total capital requirement, of 84 mil, of which 70 mil was ICRC. And it's a pretty good guess that their ICRC was driven by OAVR. So suddenly... the wrong clicker. That old trick. Thank you. So suddenly you've got potentially 70 mil of 280 mil explicable by a single company being Atradius, which helps to raise credit insurers to one of the relevant classes of insurer for which OAVR is relevant. If you also dig into those stats, you'll see at a slightly different year end, Avant had a total capital requirement of 206 mil, of which 27 mil was ICRC. And again, it's a pretty good guess that that was OAVR. Avant is a medical indemnity insurer. And so by doing that process of looking down the list of insurers, there are quite a few where you can pick them out and say, I don't really know, because the way that APRA publish their stats, they don't really want you to know too much about individual insurers. But I've got a pretty good guess that that these particular insurers are those for whom OAVR is the one that bites. And when you classify those insurers into what type of insurance they provide, you get a table that looks a little bit like this. So what are the OAVR classes which are not present in this table, which you might expect to see? CTP springs to mind. It's a big casualty class with a lot of potential for accumulation. Doesn't appear on this list. Why is that? Probably because it is written exclusively by large multi-line insurers for whom a property natural peril driven concentration risk is the one that dominates. Similarly, you've got public liability and products liability that don't appear here. And then you've also got underrepresented classes of business that do appear here, like workers' compensation or travel or marine, which again are underwritten in large part by large multi-line insurers. So this is not a list of the insurance classes for which OAVR is necessarily most relevant. It depends on your definition of relevance, but it's those that for the company as a whole, OAVR at a particular point in time may have dominated. Another interesting observation when you look at a table like this is looking into the professional lines, you know, where so your professional lines, professional indemnity, directors and officers, what types of profession are dominating the OAVR. Well, here, according to this table, you've got medical indemnity that walks all over the rest, 10 times as big. Why is that? In part because medical indemnity insurance tends to be provided by a few standalone medical indemnity providers, and other professions, some other professions are underwritten by large multi-line insurers. In part because medical in being a doctor is a dangerous business, and they tend to come with potential for large claims. So there's a few different things going on there. And there are quite a few, we've called them specialty lines. There are quite a lot of insurers that specialise in a particular type of insurance where OAVR is quite relevant. So on a frequency basis, if we had the data, I expect there would be quite a few insurers for whom OAVR forms a relevant component of their capital calculation. So now that we've got a broad picture of how OAVR fits into the overall picture of the money you need to hold as a general insurer and the types of insurers for whom it's most important, I'll hand back to Adrian to walk you through some of the things that are relevant in looking at the calculation of an OAVR.
Thanks, Tom. So we cover a few particular items. So in the following slides, there's some attempt to help in the specification of scenarios, which is challenging because it's, you know, it's a broad area. It's everything that's not natural perils that's covered by insurance and general insurance. The issue, I think, broadly, that most people we've spoken to struggle with is that they can specify what are extreme scenarios. But the prudential requirement is to specify a 1 in 200 year OAVR, and that is a real challenge. And there are very few people, I think, are very confident in assigning return periods at this sort of level. There are some CAT models, for example. There's sort of property terrorism CAT models that exist, cyber CAT models that are being built and now exist, and other, you know, sort of more simplified scenario-based models that exist. But this is a real sort of area of challenge. And there's some real... I think sort of key observations from the international experience and the historical data. So we've sort of tried to summarise those at a high level, but, it can be a rapid-moving area. So things like cyber exposure, I think, you know, the sort of there was a paper released last year by Beasley, Munich Re and Gallagher's sort of put together a joint 100-page or so paper attempting to quantify a range of market sort of sized events for cyber. They you know, acknowledge early on that there probably has not been a significant sort of cyber event that's in the 1 in 200 year return period level. So specifying that's challenging. It's very sort of first principles based. I think a sort of second challenge, which there's a lot of commentary around sort of climate change impacting the natural perils frequency and severity and potentially vulnerability as well. That's arguably more extreme in the other accumulations. So sort of historical anecdote there was after World Trade Center, I think the market for aviation terrorism insurance evaporated overnight. My recollection at the time was that went from premium side, went from 6 cents per passenger to $1 per passenger in the space of a week. And at the same time, the risk landscape changed dramatically. So there were, you know, any access to aircrafts required more intense screening. There's more security put in planes. And so arguably the risk went the other direction. So that happened very rapidly. I think, you know, you certainly see event responses in sort of in cyber or other classes where, you know, it's very hard to argue that the 200-year return period is static following those actions. I think, you know, while this may not be so the sort of strict letter of GPS 116, there is room, and we would suggest to consider secondary and tertiary impacts from primary events. So those in other jurisdictions, those are requirements to consider those in more detail. And those things might look like, you know, does your reinsurer credit change post-event, which we know it does for very large events, or will it be a competitor response, a pricing response, or potentially an underwriting response if there's no reinsurance available, all of which are quite likely. I guess one observation is in calculating these amounts is to be very careful around statements of, this type of event could not happen again because, the risk metrics that surround this class, so that might be medical indemnity would be a good example of that, would stop it from happening again. And sort of the observation on that is that most of the international equivalents, so the Lloyd's RDSs, most of them focus on events where processes have broken down. So mid-air aviation collisions are not meant to happen. There's anti-avoidance technology. There's been changes in the languages of communication that have occurred to stop those things from happening. And yet that's still the RDS because at once every 200 years, those things can fail. And that's sort of similar observations on quite a lot of them. So the things like marine collisions should not happen really. There's lots of process changes in liability classes that should avoid those things from happening. But extreme events have a really sort of good way of finding the gaps in any risk measure and sort of over-reliance on those points, I think, is definitely a risk in this particular area. Selby rail disaster, for those who don't know it well, is a head-on collision between two trains, which you would think shouldn't happen. One was derailed by a vehicle that was on the line and hit the other one coming the other way. So sort of a bit of cautionary work there. I think this flow chart is lifted from the technical paper on OEVRs. I don't know if any of the authors are here. Hopefully not. Well, thanks to them if they are. It does, amongst other things, so it does provide a lot of helpful guidance. It's not, it is a few years out of date now and some things have changed in that time. But it does provide a lot of guidance on, process mapping, how to essentially brainstorm what the scenarios might look like. And so Prudential Standard requires review of historical data, which is helpful. But a lot of practice in this space is really about getting a range of skill sets together, ideally, and considering the worst case scenarios for the class, for both for the individual classes and on a whole of portfolio level. So I think sort of as a starting point as to what sort of scenarios might you be considering here. And again, this is very general insurance focused, but there would be similar in life or health or other areas. I definitely suggest starting with a technical paper is a good place to start. Considering Lloyd's methodology is also not a bad place to start. And there are other, sort of the cyber paper is also definitely a worthwhile read. I think a lot of those start at industry level. So essentially ignore the subject portfolio to begin with, consider what are the worst case events for the industry, and then consider how those might impact the particular portfolio, and then sort of work from the other direction and consider whether that's suitable for the portfolio at risk. So this is a Slippery slope, but we've had a go at sort of listing those out for various classes, really just to give a bit of context as to what types of events we're talking about here. I think the technical paper does similar and Lloyd's do similar. I think, you know, if you don't start with this, then it's, you know, it's sort of very difficult to get going. And I think going back right to probably the 90s in Australia, there were very few stochastic catastrophe models in my early days in reinsurance. So they were very scenario-based methodologies at that time as well, which over the last couple of decades have evolved into probabilistic models for those exposures. I think a sort of key difference with natural perils is it's a bit easier to know where you start from. So it's to decide that you're going to run a Sydney earthquake model is a pretty straightforward decision. When deciding what type of cyber scenario you should run, it's not as straightforward. There's sort of more consideration needs to be given on you know, potential for risk to correlate in that space and what type of events are realistic. So we're just going to run through a few of these, and some of these are more straightforward. I think I'll sort of touch on a few that, you know, maybe are a little different. So sort of comment on credit is that, so the OAVR standard is not at all prescriptive on the parameterization of any of these events. But helpfully, there's an LMI scenario, which is very prescriptive on a series of, you know, sort of frequency and severity of loss in language and mortgage insurance, which is not exactly the same, but it does give you a framework for considering a credit scenario. I think cyber is worth a mention because it's an update essentially on, you know, since the technical paper on OAVRs was published. That's a 2024 paper. You know, it runs a series of sort of a software supply chain scenario and calculates the market loss. That's event one, event two, event three. There's a bit of a disconnect, in my view, from the Lloyd's RDS, which also runs a series of scenarios, and it's a 2025 specification. So there's no real obvious reason for that. One sort of sense check on the cyber scenarios that they run is to compare it to the global market premium. So we're talking an individual PML event, gross PML event, here being somewhere around 300 to 400% of total global premium. It's not considering that there might also be attritional losses eroding that premium. There's a lot of consideration in the paper as to whether that's reasonable or not. I think sort of considering my experience in other specialty classes, it's not unreasonable. I think from recollection, that sort of total airline premium, for example, for the market is maybe about $3.5 billion now after a bit of indexation. Most of those entities buy a similar amount of vertical limit, and so you can have several of those clashing. So that would be around a similar sort of magnitude. Yeah, I mean, travel's an interesting one. I went back to look at what the Lloyd's RDS specification said in 2019 about pandemic. It did mention it. It had one word. It said run a pandemic scenario. And it still says that. So it's not more specified, saying it needs to be global, it needs to last for a certain period of time, and it needs to have any sort of severity. It just puts the onus on the agency to run that. And APRIS sort of really does do the same here. So the onus is on the, you know, the AA through the capital charge and the board, essentially, of the general insurer through ICAP and ICAP scenarios that they need to run. I'm hopeful, I really do, I'm sure someone will think of others that we haven't thought of, but, you know, where those exist, that's really helpful, because a starting point to specifying them is to, you know, to sort of consider what are the worst case scenarios that are not natural perils for insurance classes. Yeah, there's some other interesting ones. I think I know there was an earlier presentation on pet insurance. I think, you know, that's one where we now have a specialist pet insurer in the market. It was formerly part of a larger group, so it likely didn't really matter to the overall ICRC calculation. That's no longer true. And so where you have specialty lines insurers coming out of larger consolidated groups, that's likely to be more relevant. OAVRs, you know, they are, particularly in cyber or some other spaces, they are potentially growing faster than other sort of categories of insurance in terms of the risk landscape. So they do warrant consideration. I think sort of Don will get to a few tips, I think, when I sort of hand back to him in a second. But, you know, there is a sort of risk of not updating these scenarios because they do evolve. I think one area where that may be correct is that Lloyd's terrorism RDSs, and I know that goes into a different entity in Australia, but they're still very geolocated. So they require a fixed address and apply damage ratios in a diameter around that address. I think it's not implausible by any means that that assumption that terrorism has a sort of terrorism attacks have a fixed point of sort of damage and radiating damage around that is questionable, I would argue. There's certainly possibility for sort of drone-based terrorism or cyber-based terrorism exists now. And a few others that are sort of historical context, maybe not super relevant to the Australian landscape. And back to you, Don.
Yeah, so I won't dwell on all these tips, but I will leave them up there for you to read. You know, it's notable that the GPS 116 talks about finding your biggest gross loss and then applying your reinsurance. It is advisable to also, and very particularly, think about your biggest net loss. They're not necessarily one and the same. You know, a key part of the whole concept of the insurance concentration risk charge is to test the adequacy of your reinsurance. And so thinking about your gross losses and the extent to which your reinsurance responds and what your net loss is may well highlight areas where, you know, you may want to reconsider your reinsurance. So a recent example of that was pandemic-related, where reinsurers were quite swift to exclude pandemic from their terms of coverage. It's possible that not every directly underwritten policy excluded pandemic at the same rate, and so if there was another pandemic fast following the last one, there would be a disconnect, and that would lead to a higher net loss than was potentially expected by an insurer. I will also mention, you know, a point about OAHR. When I was rattling through that earlier concept of what is your ICRC, and it's the maximum of four different things, you may ask yourself, why not consider the horizontal requirement for other accumulations? If the concept for natural perils is that it's not just about the worst individual event that can happen during a year, but the possibility of a few that could happen that between them cause you some problems. The same sort of thinking applies to other accumulations, and the guidance note does give, you know, say that this is worthy of comment in the FCR. So do think about it. It may not make your capital calculation, but it's worth the actuary turning their mind to it. That idea of breakdown of assumptions. One of the people I was talking to this morning said that generals are very good at fighting the last war. That same sort of problem can apply to OAVR. Once the pandemic has happened, everyone thinks the next most likely other accumulation is a pandemic. Well, chances are it's going to come from left field and look completely different from COVID-19 and probably be not pandemic related. But just think about the biases and how you're going about calculating your OABR. So at that, given that we only have less than 10 minutes left, and I'm keen, if possible, to get some questions, because I'm sure there are lots of people out there for whom this is a rattling, riveting topic, and you're eager to quiz the experts or be the experts yourselves.
Thanks, Don. We don't have any questions on this. contrary to Don's view. So, look, I'm happy for you to use the microphone if you don't feel like posting it up. I probably don't want their question publicly available. So, Dave, if you want to ask a question of the mic, you're more than welcome, and I won't record it. But if I'll allow you guys to... Anyone want to step up and ask a question? No? Okay, how about I kick things off? I've got a question. So I during COVID, I was the global chief actuary at QBE, and we, at the time, it wasn't for OAVR purposes. It was actually for the purpose of raising capital, because the business made certain decisions that meant we had to raise capital, but also think about how we wanted to allow for potential losses that might arise from COVID in our reserves or in our premium liabilities. So we gathered a range of experts to think about those scenarios. The one thing that is certain is we got them all wrong. So every single one of those scenarios we thought about at the time in terms of how the pandemic could play out was wrong. In those initial scenarios, we had nothing in relation to property BI losses, potentially because of wording issues around around property wordings and the wrong act being written into those wordings. So that wasn't something we had, but that became evident as a potential issue 3 or 4 months later, and then a non-issue 2 years after that, after it went through the High Court. So the one certainty is you're not going to get right. And I think the COVID-19 as well for many insurers was actually a profitable event. So we came up with big losses. I think QBs might have been somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion. I can't remember the top of my mind how much it was. And LMI was a big part of that. But I think if we were to reflect on that, and Andrew's probably got a better view of that than me, it wasn't far away from a line ball number. No loss, no profit. And the big motor insurers probably made a profit because of the frequency impact from COVID. So the question is more around, what are the learnings from COVID in terms of how you want to think about assessing your OEVR and any other accumulation scenario analysis you might do, not specifically COVID in that we got this wrong or we got that right, but more in terms of how you want to face into the OEVR. I think that was an event that might have been a non-event for some insurers, at least in terms of insurance losses, but it's certainly an event where we can learn from in thinking about the OEVR and other scenario analysis, whether it's for the ICAP or whatever else.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. I'll have a crack and then I'll pass over to Adrian. But, you know, it's interesting with those events like pandemics that take a while to unfold, because you've got the opportunity for a lot of adaptation and management action and environmental change and so on that can all impact the size of the loss. So that's my first point, I guess, is that it's that the time lag creates more complexity in the considerations that are available. And another point is that a lot of those adaptations are likely to move you in a favourable direction. You've got a sticky situation and you try to deal with it, with sometimes mixed success, but it may, generally be favorable. You know, we've talked about secondary and tertiary impacts and there are certainly cases where, bad things can lead to worse things, you know, fire following earthquake and, you know, there's a whole lot of examples of bad stuff leading to worse stuff, but bad stuff can lead to slightly less bad stuff as well. So that's something to keep in mind. And even on you know, the specifics of COVID around business interruption, which, you know, turned out to be, you know, one of the interesting points with out-of-date policy wording was one of the key learnings, you know, referencing out-of-date acts and, you know, unintentional exposure, in essence, because of the attitude of, well, we did this last year, it seemed okay, we'll do it again. And so at some stage, having a fresh look and ensuring that the exposure is what you think it is worthwhile. So there are a few learnings for me. Adrian?
Yeah, and I think that's that's an important point, that question of net versus gross 1-200. OEVR is certainly a space where you can have multiple reinsurance covers. And so your net 1-200 could actually be, the gross that leads to your net could be very different from your gross 1-200. We do have a question here for Don and Adrian, and I'm going to cheekily extend this to David. Given the challenge of credibly estimating a 1-200 event, do you think APRA should change the requirements to something else?
Oh.
Don, I'll let you respond to that.
I'll give David a chance to think.
He said no.
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges you've got is if a lot of the common practice is to think of something pretty bad, then the challenge is assigning a probability to it. Is that a 1 in 200? Is it a 1 in 50? Is it a 1 in 500? And it's quite plausible you'd have three experts in the one area that would each fall at those points, and it has a significant difference in the amount that you choose to include in your calculation. So the calibration part of an OEVR, I think, is quite a challenge. And it's, you know, for that reason that it's handy to have things like the LMI capital risk charge being so prescriptive that you can hang your hat on APRA, who essentially take the risk of it being 1 in 200 and say, well, this is, if that's what they have said is 1 in 200 for lenders mortgage insurers, then it's probably good enough for us as credit insurers to do something comparable. Not every class has an easy translation point like that. And, you know, a whole underpinning of extreme value theory and curve extrapolation and so on is that the big bad stuff is likely to be underrepresented. And so when you think of bad stuff and it finally emerges, it may well be worse. So any guidance on you know, how to set that 1 in 200 is would be wonderful. David. Or would you prefer not to be put on the spot?
We're going to have to close there. I'll just finish by saying thanks to Adrian and Don, ask you to give them a round of applause for what was an interesting session.